This is Black Guy, White Guy Talking. I'm a black guy. I'm Elwin.
I'm a white guy. I'm Zach.
And we became friends by talking. Talking about race and race relations. This episode was recorded on June 24, 2021.
Yusuf Kumanyaka is from Bogalusa, Louisiana. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994 for Neon Vernacular. He served in the U.S. Army in the war in Vietnam. His new book is Everyday Mojo Songs of Earth, New and Selected Poems, 2001 to 2021. Welcome, Yusuf.
Thanks a lot for the invite.
I wanted to start out because I'm aware, and I read the first installment, really liked it, of this new comic book series, Jupiter Invisible, that has just been launched. And I wonder if you could say something about that project and how it came to be.
Well, it came to be by me saying yes to an idea that Ram Delavante had a year and a half ago. So I wrote the story, and Ashley E. Woods provided the artwork, and it came to life. So I was really surprised by just how easy it was, and the fact that we engage such a severe topic as slavery.
Will new issues continue to be released?
This is the first installment. Yes, there are going to be other issues as well. This is just the beginning. This is the first door that's been opened to Jupiter's life, which is unusual, really, because I see it as an element of magical realism as well.
Mm.
First of all, he's born as an albino, so automatically he's doubly outcast within the context of many societies, not just African-American society or American society, but African societies as well.
You brought up the fact that he was albino. I know albinos have obviously been around since the beginning of humanity, but they're rarely talked about in history and slavery times. So do you know if there's any like real connection to that?
I don't know of any connection to that.
Right.
But when it entered my psyche, it was magical because I said, well, this story has a double meaning, and I just went with it. I think that's what happens when one is a creative artist.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we are given gifts. I saw that as a moment where I had been given a gift. I could go many directions with it. As a matter of fact, the story is that his mother dies in childbirth, and I don't want to give the whole story away,
right?
Because he ventures to that netherworld, that world between worlds, a kind of psychological limbo.
You know, when you're actually looking at the comic, as you look at him, you're like, is he light skinned? But then you're like, okay, like that's the first thing that comes to your mind is he light skinned? And it's like, but you can tell he's not really light skinned, but that explains it. He's albino, and that kind of throws everything off when you're going through it. It's like, but he also looks like the way he appears in the comic, he looks like superhuman. I guess that's the magical part of it.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I hope so.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was received
but in
that way.
Upon analysis, how is he accepted as a human being?
Right.
Well, I sort of surprised myself. And sometimes when I write poetry, I come to a line and I say, well, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I laugh about it. Mm. So those moments are gifts when I'm surprised.
That's awesome. It's awesome that you can recognize that and then regurgitate it and like appreciate that gift.
Thank you.
Talking about how you know a poem is finished, you called the process an intense negotiation. Could you say more about that?
I think it has a lot to do with my method of writing. Initially, the poem is more of an improvisation. So I'm just going with what some people may call the flow, but I don't necessarily call it the flow. I call it improvisation. And often I have written past the essence from the poem. Sometimes the poem has gone on, for 99 lines, when in fact, when I cut it back, it's probably 45 lines or even shorter. So that's my method of generating the energy, the images, and all, because in some sense, they have to surprise me. I don't see myself as a journalist. You know, journalism, which I embrace and love, but I think creative writing is something entirely different. There is a process of negotiation, yes.
What was the birth of that gift? What started you on this journey?
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I was born in Louisiana, and I had a certain kind of freedom to venture out any place in that very interesting space, not realizing that also I was connecting myself to the imagination. For instance, okay, even at 5 years old, I would venture out of the woods, you know, and I felt safe, even if I was alone or with other boys. And it was a way of discovering, and where you're observing, but also you're beginning to see into things. And it's that whole thing about seeing into things that interests me more than just your typical observation. That's kind of clinical. I wanted to know how things are put together and how they exist, how they're made. So nature is constantly surprising us. I think maybe that's where it really began.
Appreciation of nature.
Yes.
From there to where you are now, did you have like this conventional path, a goal in mind of where you wanted to be, or what did you want to share?
I come across James Baldwin's essays, a book, Nobody Knows My Name. I came across that collection of essays, and I have to admit, I was 14 and I had never read anything like that. So for a long time, I thought I would write essays, looking at things that I took for granted. But I started reading poems as well. It was during what was called Negro History Week. That's when I was introduced to Phyllis Wheatley, Dunbar, to Langston Hughes, to some of the protest writers who were writing sonnets, really. Some of the people, such as Claude McKay, who wrote If We Must Die, which is such a powerful poem. It was so powerful that that poem was read to the English by Churchill in World War II, If We Must Die. So I related to the rhythms in language. I think of language as our first music in the body, is an amplifier, if that makes sense, you know, that you feel when you are speaking, you feel the rhythms, especially, I think, when you're small, when you are just experiencing the glory of the world. You know, I think maybe that's where the impulse to actually put the pencil or paper to the paper and actually write a line. It also goes back to, I loved listening to the radio early on when I was 4 and 5. I would sing alone, okay, but I would never sing the lyrics that came out of the radio. I was making my lyrics up. I don't know, in retrospect, if they made any sense, but I was just having fun, I suppose.
Like improv.
That's part of writing, as well.
You wrote that Langston Hughes, alongside Zora Neale Hurston, Gene Toomer, and Helene Johnson, was one of the most innovative voices of the Harlem Renaissance, and that, like Walt Whitman, the pulse and throb of Hughes' vision is driven by an acute sense of beauty and tragedy in America's history. I wonder whether the same is true for you, and whether you would expand on that.
Oh, gosh, yes. It's interesting where things converge. I think those poets, they witness, but they also celebrate it. I started saying that poetry has to, for myself, has to be confrontation and celebration. Let's face it. That's an interesting, I think, an interesting way of facing the world, and it's how complex it is, you know. I said that early on, and I still believe that. And there's an intense seeing, but also there's an intense listening. I think that's what those poets were doing as well. They were listening to everything happening around them. And consequently, they knew what was happening to them. I trust that. I trust the spirit of the individual.
As I understand it, your grandfather's name was Kumanyaka.
There's all kinds of stories centered around that, a variation of that coming from the West Indies, probably Trinidad. But also, you know, time is a part of loss as well. So I never really wanted to tack everything down, but I used it as a place that I could embrace and jump off from.
And I think I remember you saying there's a freedom in names.
There's a freedom, for sure. I think so.
I often come back to your poem, Facing It. You've talked about how it took you 14 years to be able to write about your experiences in Vietnam. And the final image of that poem, in the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair. I find the tenderness of that final image against the background of war and death stunning. I wonder if you could talk about that poem or about the 14 years it took you to write about those experiences.
You know, I thought I would write essays about the war. I had taken with me to Vietnam an anthology of poems, New American Poetry, I think, edited by Donald Allen. And I had also taken with me a novel titled Five Smooth Stones. So I was reading poetry in Vietnam, but I thought, I don't even know why I took those books with me. It was just impulse, you know. I don't know how many soldiers actually took books with them, but I'm surmising that quite a few did. At least I hope so. I was teaching composition in New Orleans at University of New Orleans at the time. And it was summertime as well. I didn't plan to write about Vietnam, but I was renovating a house, working on, you know, they had what they called the horse plaster walls, horse hair in the walls, you know, and trying to refinish that, those walls and what have you, journeying up a high ladder and what have you. And I had a pad of paper down on the floor, and I would write an image down. A first poem I started writing related to Vietnam somewhere near Phu Ba. And the second poem I wrote was Facing It. That poem is so different than some of the other poems I've written, because when I got to that last line, that I could not go any farther, you know, I felt it was finished. It's strange. That's one of the few poems that I've written that way. Maybe that's a gift, I hope, too.
I wonder, does poetry release you from trauma when you write it, or when it's received by a listener, or both, or neither?
I think it's an interesting moment of communication. It's not an outward motion. It is a motion where it comes towards us and enters us to a certain extent, because images are very interesting in that the fact that those images are taken in, and one may be asleep, but the image is still doing its work. It is still there because the mind, the brain, is trying to make some sense out of it. And sometimes a single image, it can take us so many different places, and that's why there's a kind of active negotiation going on as well. There's a back and forth. There's a kind of, and finally one arrives at a place where one fully understands a moment, not necessarily a whole emotional, psychological landscape, but one understands a moment in one's complex existence.
You said somewhere that the history of violence is woven through the national psyche.
Yes.
I wonder if you could say more about that, also with regard to masks the psyche wears, masks of racism or violence or other kinds of masks.
Well, it's interesting because I think the country is really based on certain elements of violence. And sometimes it comes out of just what we do in order to exist. What I mean by that, I'm just thinking about how the country was founded. It wasn't that the terrain was totally peaceful because, let's face it, there were elements of war in the landscape already. But we brought, when I say we, I mean when individuals took that voyage across the Atlantic and came to Plymouth Rock was an interesting moment because in the soil was a kind of a violence in a way, because I think they came across human bones and things of this sort. That would cause an alarm, I would think. And also, if we think about decades, a few decades later, we had indentured servants here. We had indentured servants before slaves were brought. Mm-hmm. And those indentured servants, they were not treated well. They were working off the 7 years that they owed the ship captain in that exchange, you know. I think it was conquest from the very first moment. Even though, if we think about that first winter, where I think the ration was a pint of peas. And sometimes in the peas were worms, you know. That must have been a very trauma-driven moment for the people who arrived. And then they were saved by the grace of the Native American, who knew something about coal, knew something about ways of keeping warm. Probably they had also stored certain grain and what have you. So we came here, and then what do we visit on them a year or so later, right? Mm. Yeah, violence. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. But would that be so different from other cultures? I don't think it's really that different from other cultures as well.
When we come into this world, it's violent. Mm. You know, when we're born, it's a violent process. It's not a peaceful process.
But we also have the capacity to embrace the opposite of that.
Yeah.
That's what's so interesting about the human being.
Right.
And I think it has a lot to do with just the brain. You know, we haven't always possessed that capacity. This is what I feel. I feel that this capacity came out of evolution. Mm-hmm. Because if we can just jump back, you know, generations after generations into where we are on the land, we are in a new landscape. How do we confront that landscape? It's not so much that we're thinking about, do we overcome that landscape? But I think it is how we survive.
It's survival, mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. I think that through making the connection to violence, like I said, when we come into this world, it's violent, but the gift is life. It's like everything else, it's struggle. Most of the things that we have to endure, and I think the origin of that is birth. That's the closest thing that you can relate to, the most natural form of violence, so to speak. You know, when you look at it that way, once you reach certain levels in life, most of the time it's going through a lot of strife and it's going through a lot of turmoil, and especially when you're trying to make connections, like conversing, like how we're doing now, like, you know, erasing barriers and breaking down barriers, you know, right. there's a lot of pain that comes with a lot of violence that comes with that. But after that, most of the time, the gift of that is some new birth of some new existence, some new form of changing form of life, or something different or better than what it was before, you know.
Right. Sometimes it's no more than a question.
Mm. Mm.
And that question connects us.
Mm.
And then there's a kind of process of negotiation, the give and the take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back and forth. That's necessary. Sometimes that happens in the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have any control over it.
That's true.
Yeah.
You've talked about racism as a mental illness, as a kind of cultivated schizophrenia. I'd love to hear more about that. It makes so much intuitive sense to me.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. The question was early on about, you know, when I first went to school, I had a triple major, and psychology was one of them. And I thought I would go that direction. And perhaps I wanted to go that direction because in my observation, in my reading and what have you, I felt that racism, because I was just thinking about logic, because elements of racism is so illogical. And I said, well, is it possibly, if it happens over a certain period of time, does it corrupt the individual to the extent that one becomes illogical in one's, I hope that makes sense.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
How it can corrupt the individual.
How does it, yes. An individual can be very logical and pragmatic about his or her everyday life, so many things. And this one thing stands out where that individual is so illogical that we have a moment of violence. How about the fact that we're just, you know, some people are just becoming aware of the fact that Tulsa, Oklahoma, what happened in,
mm-hmm.
you know, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many of those incidents based mm-hmm. solely on race. So I think, could it be also that same thing can happen if you look at tribes, how one tribe battles another
mm-hmm.
and do some really horrific things? Because those kinds of things must have been happening based solely on violence, based solely on suppressing or defeating a certain group.
And you're talking about within the same race too, right?
Yes.
Right.
Within the same race,
mm-hmm.
even. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good
point. So all these conflicts
mm-hmm.
are happening. Sometimes it's no more than physical space. Then other times it becomes what we think of as psychological, emotional space. Like there's a whole argument today in 2021 about what's being taught in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know? When in fact, if one approaches the whole of history and teach the facts, the truth, how can we go wrong with that? The problem happens when one tries to badger another group as if we're in war, as if we're there to subdue them in a certain sense and not improve the overall lot of humanity. Truth cannot be used as a club to seduce another group. I don't believe that.
Mm. Well, as you're talking, the only thing that keeps coming back to mind is what you said before. As we're talking about race, it's like we can slice it up as much as we want to, but I still think that the common denominator, it's still survival, you know? It
yes.
really is still okay. survival. It's like when you really think about it, you know, even the word race itself, like what a race, racism, when you really think about it, it's like it is what the word is inherently. Race, what are we all lining up to against each other? And when you include the word racism, what immediately comes to your mind is like separation,
right,
you know,
right,
competition, separation. That one common word that's the common denominator, which is really, it's the foundation of it is survival. So if you're racing towards anything, it's like, what are we racing towards? Who's the victor?
Yeah, that's right. You can put another word in front of it, right? Mm-hmm. Human.
Human, exactly. Mm. Human race.
Right.
That's exactly what it is. And we split up the human race, and then where are we going? What is the goal? And the goal in this life, from what I see and from everything, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, it's survival. It's like, it really is just survival. Who is going to survive?
But it has become more than survival, I think, because as a collective, there is a certain strength. And we see that, especially if we think about the history of certain wars that we have fought that brought people together. World War II was one of them, you know,
mm-hmm.
where America, it's very strange because black soldiers went to fight, white soldiers went to fight, and not that they were even fighting in the same units or anything like that, but they were supposedly fighting for the same goal. But maybe tangled up in that is the fact that it was all a lie anyway. You know?
So what are you fighting for?
Sometimes it becomes very complex. And often, what one individual says is quite different than what another individual says.
Mm-hmm.
Because the facts, the elements of truth are different. Mm-hmm. Not that there's so much those individuals so different as human beings, but just what they have ingested.
Mm.
Different. So, yes, it's complex.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Very, very complex.
You said that after reading the Bible a second time through, you began to see Christ as a socialist. I wonder if you could talk about that.
That was so long ago when I think about it. It was after I had read, really, Baldwin. And I knew Baldwin had hot, even his first novel, Gotelin on a Mountain, you know. It's about that early experience of coming to in his own as a very youthful preacher. And he had a gift for it, you know. And I said, well, I found myself, just growing up in the South especially, reading the Bible very with intent, with my eyes and ears open, you know. I read it through, and then I said, well, let me try it again. Because I began to question things. It's an amazing, creative document, you know. It's also history is there as well. Poetry is there. I want to underline that poetry is there because I have a friend, Willis Bernstone, who has translated the Bible. And he definitely has found so many poems just in the language and just the flow of language, the rhythm, metaphor, and what have you. I feel that I came to a place where I began to write down notes and I suppose stepped away from the text because I had this belief that the Christ figure was definitely a socialist. But I think that was his grace, but I had other arguments, just, you know, with myself more than anything else. I saw the fact that he was thinking about his fellow human beings in such an intense revolutionary way where he was... The one thing that he does in found analysis that gets him nailed to the cross is when he thrashes the money lenders from the temple. Does that make sense?
Mm. Okay. It does. Yeah, in Blue Notes, you wrote, it seems that as contemporary people, we're very fearful of silence. And I won't read the whole quote, but you ended by saying, I don't know, but I now realize silence is not an endurance test for me, and it never was.
That has a lot to do with the fact that I could walk out into nature and be at home. You know, even though nature is not totally silent, of course, with the singing of the birds, the singing of the insects and whatever, and also the mind is fully at work, taking in everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we are always reaching towards. Let's hope we are. A dialogue. And sometimes that dialogue is with oneself, but also others. And life is an intense moment and a negotiation. We have to be able to open our arms and say, yes, here it is. Deal with it, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I think small children are so much that way.
Mm-hmm.
They're amazing because we watch and they can humanize us.
We can learn from them.
We can learn.
If we allow ourselves to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Yusuf.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really amazed by what the two of you are doing, you know, this dialogue, right? And I'm quite sure all of them are different. Yeah. I noticed you have John Maria over there. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great to talk with him as well.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
We also,
yeah.
Actually, I have a question I was kind of apprehensive about asking, but it has to do with the rhyming in poetry. Like, I actually have a fondness for poetry, but my expressive pattern is through rhyme. I'm intrigued by the rhythm in the words and the way they come together. But when I was reading your poems and then listening to you read your poems, you know, at first, you know, I had to adjust myself because, you know, it's not what I'm used to hearing. But as I started listening intently, I was immediately seeing images as opposed to paying attention like so closely to the words. I was allowing the words to manifest, but even though the words weren't rhyming, as you're talking, like it became so powerful that I was seeing what you were saying. And it's like more compact as opposed to, you know, long-winded. So it's like the power in the words, like you, the way the words connected, but then to have a vivid image of what you're saying. I understood it. Like, the first of my question was going to be, do you feel like the rhyming in poetry is a mediocre form of communication, or is it just another form? You know,
that's an interesting one. Yes. I would like to say this, that when I first started writing, sometimes I still write lyrics. I do rhyme lyrics. In writing poetry, I rely heavily on the image and the musicality that's in language. Because if we were writing in a romance language, it would be entirely different. But I often say there, one can only rhyme pain with rain for so long. That's the limitation of someone like Seamus Heaney, I'm thinking of. Some of his rhymes are quite interesting for the simple reason because he is using language in a different way. How he formed certain tonal experience about just connecting two words and creating the sound and the intent of the image just by using a hyphen, which is very interesting, you know. I feel that, I know what you're talking about because if you go to the what I call the protest sonnets written during the Harlem Renaissance, of course you're going to find the end rhymes and what have you. But the subject matter is so different that it creates a certain kind of urgency. And we embrace the rhyme for a simple reason. We are embracing that moment in history. That's what people were writing at that particular time, I think. For myself, I trust the image.
Yeah, that's what I saw for sure. Experienced that.
In Blue Notes, you wrote about improvisation and revision. You wrote that for me, it's always a cutting back, a honing that compresses energy.
I feel that still.
Resisting resolution.
Yes, because the reason I'm resisting resolution most times is the fact that I want to invite the reader in as co-creator of meaning, where the reader is participating in place of just, you know, responding to something that's been told. That a poem can have more than one meaning. It's not just nailed to the ground, I should say, with a single meaning. That becomes only an ad for an emotion. And speaking of ads, I think, if we think about, I've been saying I would write about this, but now I'm about to talk about it. I think there's a certain generation where the TV was the babysitter. And consequently, the children heard a lot of ads. And usually they were jingles and they rhymed. They rhymed. And that was taken in. This is what I feel and believe. Notice how that's how people write ads, right?
It's like programming. It's a way to get the point across and make it stick
attention
the way you want it to. As opposed to you know, allowing the receiver to have a thought process about it.
I think the kids they didn't even realize they were listening as intently as they were.
But there was intention there. It was all intention to get them to just be programmed to remember what they heard.
They pointed to certain boxes of cereal because there may be 100 boxes of cereal in a certain, you know, big store or what have you. But they are pointing to certain boxes, right?
They're
picking on them.
It's very true.
It's a simple message.
Yep.
Teach the children. teach the children which cereal they want to take home.
It's very interesting what happened, you know?
Just kind of brought it full circle, because it's like, now I understand the reason for what I perceive to be your reasoning or your feeling towards this way of communicating. You know, it's about the exchange and the dialogue.
The dialogue
that you, that's the engagement. It's like really engaging from the person who created to the person who is receiving it. There's an exchange
Right. Yeah.
There's an intense exchange.
Yeah. Co-creators of meaning. Yeah.
It's dope.
Yes. Here we are.
Yeah, I love that. So whereas an ad strives for simplicity of message and telling everyone the same thing and encouraging them to want the same thing, art, whether it's a poem or a painting or a song or a sculpture or what have you, can reach for something more complex and can invite the viewer or the listener or the reader in to help create that meaning.
Otherwise, the reader is totally passive.
Disengaged.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's a wonderful conversation.
Yeah.
Yes. Take care of yourselves.
All right. Thank you. You take care of Yusuf.
You too, Yusuf. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
It's great. It's great to speak to both of you. Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now.
As a disclaimer, Zach and I don't pretend to speak for all white or all black people.